Hello and welcome. It's been a good week. In the polls for Donald Trump, it seems, for the first time in 2 months, several US election forecasters suggesting he may be ahead in key swing states by a wafer-thin margin. And this comes despite his character being questioned again, this time by the former president's chief of staff, John Kelly, describing his old boss as fitting the description of a fascist. Trump's response, Kelly was a low-life bad general who needed to move on. Meanwhile, in the battle for headlines on the campaign trail, Elon Musk has been offering million-dollar giveaways to registered voters. Trump was loving it in McDonald's, something the Democrats were quick to seize on.
Well, I'm looking for a job, and I've always wanted to work at McDonald's, but I never did.
Being at McDonald's, he looks much more like Ronald McDonald than the clown that he actually is.
It's been a week where Vladimir Putin made every effort to show he was far from an international pariah, 2.5 years on from Russia's full-scale offensive in Ukraine, personally greeting world leaders in the Russian city of Kazan for the BRICS summit of emerging economies. A notable face at the table, Turkey's leader, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the only NATO presence in the room.
I know that Turkey is interested in establishing close cooperation with the BRICS group and sees significant prospects here. And Turkey has a special geopolitical role.
And it's been a week that's seen the US Secretary of State on his 11th tour of the Middle East, the international hope for peace that increased after last week's killing of Yahya Sinwar, Israel's number one target in Gaza, appears to be ebbing away, a continuation of relentless bombardment in the north of the territory. Is anyone listening to Antony Blinken? Despite the talks, words aren't deeds. Is US influence in Israel on hold until the outcome of the election there?
We had an opportunity today to talk about the way forward on the effort to bring the hostages home and to get a ceasefire. Partly, this involves an assessment of exactly where Hamas stands in the wake of the death of Sinwar.
Welcome to The World This Week. And with me on the panel tonight, from London, the international affairs editor for Channel 4 News, Lindsay Hilsum, author of I Brought the War With Me, Stories and Poems from the Frontline. Lindsay, it is a pleasure to have you with us tonight. And we're going to talk in detail about your book later. But poetry, I just want to mention, is very important to you from a young age. I understand your mother is a French tutor, and she read poetry to you, didn't she?
She did. My mother was British, but she was a French teacher. And I can't remember a time when we weren't reading poetry. And I've always loved it since a child. And whenever I'm travelling as a journalist, I always have a book of poetry with me.
Right, we're going to get into that very shortly. Great to have you here. Let's go from London to Riga. Let's bring in Inna Strazdina, the presenter, international correspondent at LTV Latvia. Inna, hello. You've been covering a significant summit in Latvia this week relating to Crimea. Tell us about that.
Right. Hello, Gavin. Hello, friends. This week in Riga was very, very busy. We had Crimea, International Crimea Platform Summit, where many international delegations came, more than 40 countries, and of course, Ukraine. We had delegation from Verkhovna Rada, which is parliament in Ukraine. So we had we heard a lot of discussions here, but also very personal stories from Crimea Tatars, how they lived during occupation and how they were jailed and what's going on in Crimea now. So lots of information which we can't get otherwise. So we could hear these stories from eyewitnesses.
Yeah, it is great to hear stories from you tonight as well, particularly with the east of Ukraine, Putin's orbit with the BRICS summit as well this week. Also here with us in the studio, a knight no less, Amar Abed Rabo, French-Syrian photojournalist, awarded a Knight of Art and Literature here in France from the French government for his work. Also your work used by Banksy for Dismoland, the exhibition. Fantastic to have you here. You're just back from Lebanon.
Yeah, I was there when Nasrallah was killed, so almost 3 weeks now, and to follow the developing story, of course. It It's a bit painful to talk today about it in a very nice place and very nice studio, where it's a bit cold. But to know that some colleagues of us, some reporters, were targeted last night and three of them were killed. And it seems totally normal now anymore. I mean, we don't even hear, sometimes you hear the Quai d'Orsay or other people complain or they're angry or something. But we don't even have this anymore. It became something totally normal. And it's a shame.
We're looking at some of your photography in recent days in Lebanon. You're right as well, because it's news today. These three journalists in the south, there's a compound, several guest houses, about 18 or so different media companies, all clearly marked as well. And we're still waiting for international responses to it. Lebanese government saying, quote, this is a war crime. We're waiting to hear from the IDF. But just talk us through some of these images of the past week. We just saw a Hezbollah sign, I think, didn't we, tattooed into somebody's head.
Yes, it was the inside the southern suburb. So, yeah, I thought this tattoo was very, very interesting and sums up the story in a way. It's complicated to work in this situation because, as I said, sometimes the reporters are targeted, and sometimes on the ground, when you go, people became extremely paranoid after the beepers explosions and knowing that they are infiltrated or they are spies or things like that. So when you arrive with your cameras, they're not comfortable at all. So it's very complicated to work because you're targeted from both sides. So having these photos is almost a miracle because, we still have to witness, we still have to tell stories, we still have to report. But it's getting more and more complicated and difficult.
Amal, thank you. We're going to get to that in a minute when we talk about frontline journalism. Also with us on the programme, Ana Navarro Pedro, the independent journalist, Portuguese writer, journalist based here in France. You've been looking into the abyss this weekend, a financial abyss of the French budget. You've been comparing it with the Portuguese budget.
Yes.
Which fares better?
Because they are both passing a parliament at the same time and circumstances are very different. And here in France is a kind of a struggle and almost a fight, a battle between opposition and the government, and no one agrees on anything. There is no parliamentary compromise on the budget when the situation is very dire for France on the financial front. In Portugal, there was a compromise between the right wing in power and the socialists in opposition. The government also negotiated some points of the budget with the unions and with the bosses. I don't know what the name is. The entrepreneurs organizations. There are some points. There are some friction points still. But in the end, the Socialist Party decided that it will abstain, will not vote against the budget, even if it doesn't agree with it all. Because they don't want to put the country in some political instability. That is also quite a contrast with France. And last but not least, we have a surplus in our budget from last year. There will be one for this year. The next budget, the one who's being now going through parliament, will also have a surplus, meaning more money comes in than the one that goes out. At the same time, we are giving leeway to demand and paying our debt in advance. And it's not austerity that has made this what Paul Krugman, American economist and Nobel Prize for economy, has called the Portuguese miracle. So, many contrasts with France. Well, we are a small country and France is a big one.
But brighter days right now in Portugal. We may discuss this next week, depending on what happens with the budget here in France. Well, first of all, the big issue of the week, 11 days to go until elections. Sunday afternoon, Feasterville, Pennsylvania, a campaign stop, publicity stunt, and McDonald's for Donald Trump. He tells reporters he'd always wanted to work there to operate the French fry cooker and said he was doing so now because he claimed it was fake news that his rival, Kamala Harris, had once worked there at college. Lying Kamala, he called her, as he handed out McNuggets to his supporters. Including
$6,000. Now I have worked at McDonald's. I've now worked for 15 minutes more than Kamala. She never worked here. I've now worked 15 minutes more than Kamala. So
did she work there? Kamala Harris has previously referenced working at McDonald's in the Bay Area in the early 80s to help fund her way through law school. McDonald's press office, or McDo's as we say here in France, told reporters it couldn't confirm claims by either camp because its records don't extend back to when the vice president would have been serving French fries. Well, some analysts cite the dead cat strategy when Donald Trump is facing the heat of scrutiny elsewhere. He throws up something else to distract. Plenty to distract this week after revelations from the renowned journalist Bob Woodward that Trump had spoken seven times to President Putin since the full-scale Ukraine offensive and had even sent him a COVID testing machine. By Wednesday, we'd also hear another ex-member of Trump's inner circle, the former White House chief of staff, General John Kelly, coming out swinging the stripe. Donald Trump as a fascist.
Certainly, the former president is in the far right area. He's certainly an authoritarian. Admires people who are dictators. He has said that. So he certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure.
Kelly went on to quote that Trump, he said, wanted generals like Hitler had and suggested Hitler, quote, did some good things. Trump responded on social media, calling Kelly, quote, a dumb, low-life degenerate, to move on. Well, the Democrats, meanwhile, were focusing on celebrity power to headline their rallies, creating their own viral moment in the form of Eminem in Detroit on Tuesday, Beyonce in Texas today, Barack Obama trending for this midweek.
I'm here tonight. I have done a lot of rallies, so I don't usually get nervous. But I was feeling some kind of way following Eminem. Now notice my palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. Vomit on my sweater already, mom's spaghetti. I'm nervous, but on the surface I look calm and ready to drop bombs, but I keep on forgetting. Dun, 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 dun. I thought Eminem was going to be performing. I was going to jump out. Love me some Eminem.
OK, I haven't had a chance even to mention Elon Musk's legally, ethically questionable million-dollar daily giveaways to registered voters who signed his petition in swing states. Anna Navarro, as the famed US news anchor Dan Rather used to say, it's closer than a too tight bathing suit in a too long car ride home from the beach. What are you making of the race?
Well, the resume we just had shows bread and circus. The circus is there, the bread. We'll see afterwards. That's probably what is missing to a lot of voters for Trump. Secondly, we don't know what the issue will be because there are a lot of fake news and a lot of manipulation of polls and, you know, in the social networks and so forth. There is one thing that upsets me a lot and should upset all of us is right now in the social networks in the United States is almost acquired by algorithms, you know, going in the way of Trump supporters that Trump will win. If he does not win, and let's say that Lichtman, which is this professor who has created a model with 13 keys that has for many, many, many elections in the United States always given the right answer, the right person. He came out yesterday and he said, my model still gives Kamala Harris as winner. If that is the case, with all the Trump's electors thinking that he's going to win and the paranoia that goes around in that camp, especially since 2020, well, we'll have a very dire situation in the United States.
Lindsay, a very dire situation in the United States, says Anna Navarro. One thing that interests me, we've got Donald Trump doing Joe Rogan's show, the biggest podcast in the US, about 14.5 million followers on Spotify, triple that of his nearest rival. There was talk, wasn't there, of Kamala Harris doing it. Do you? Some of the supporters saying that it's too free-rolling, it's too much of a risk. Where do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, she is not always absolutely brilliant in interview. She did a very popular podcast called Call Me Daddy with a young woman presenter, and then she's reaching out to women. And certainly gender is this huge issue in this contest because she is much more popular amongst women than Donald Trump is. And that's partly because of abortion. She supports a woman's right to choose. And it's partly just her persona, and particularly young women. But the question is always, are you going to get those young women actually out to vote? And the problem for Kamala Harris is that her trend line is no longer up. It was a very steep up, and now it's leveled off, and now it's not clear if it's going down again. And then I also wonder, how many undecided voters are there these days? Yeah. Many people have already voted. There's a lot of early voting, and that's both Democrats and Republicans. And I'm not sure that there are many votes to be won. So we're seeing all this frantic stuff, all those celebrities. A lot of people who vote for Donald Trump, and I covered the last election, I'm not going to do this one, they see those celebrities as East Coast, West Coast elite. They don't necessarily, they might like their music or their films, but they don't necessarily have sway on who they're going to vote for. And so it's not clear to me that all of the stuff that we're seeing now is going to make any difference.
It's very interesting. I was talking to the company at the Silver Bulletin election forecasters a few days ago, who were saying exactly that the star power, the Taylor Swift, the Beyoncés, they don't have, well, they're not seeing the dial move. They did say Elon Musk seems to be moving the dial, which is very interesting. Given what Lindsay was saying, Amar, when you look... Sorry, Lindsay,
well,
carry
I
on.
I wonder whether you could... Yeah, I'm just going to say... Yeah, I was going to say Elon Musk. I was looking at Moldova and Georgia and the elections there. And in both Moldova and Georgia, you have an oligarch who's basically bought up a particular side or a particular party, Georgian Dream in Georgia, and the anti-EU campaign in Moldova. And I was thinking, is Elon Musk an oligarch? Is he doing the same thing? This thing of offering $1 million to people in a swing state who will sign a petition, you know, he's been warned by the Justice Department that this is potentially illegal. But you look at him, you look at the Koch brothers. I wonder if American politics is as different and as democratic as Americans like to think?
Good question.
It's a very good point. Inna, I'm going to bring you here into this because there is a school of thought, particularly coming from Russian bot farms, that actually Elon Musk is doing their work for them on X, formerly Twitter, given the amount of, well, positive disinformation tweets that he doesn't say this is true. He says, is this true?
Yeah, actually, this is, Gavin, I can tell you, this is huge news today also in Latvia that Wall Street Journal found out that Elon Musk was in contact with Putin many times. And this is also very, very confusing because I can tell you that when I go to Ukraine, there is a different opinion about Elon Musk as he was helping at the beginning of the war with satellite systems. So all the information is super, super confusing, but what we see on X and what we see on these public actions of Elon Musk, he obviously supports Trump, but if he is in contact with Putin all of the time, so it's very worrying complex, at least for us.
Amar, it's interesting just listening to the idea that we've just heard of a trajectory that Kamala Harris seemed to have appear to be falling away. Where do you see that trajectory right now? As we look at some of the polls, including from The Economist today, suggesting that in the states that matter, Donald Trump is ahead.
Yes, it seems that in these states, the margin of errors of the polls is a bit too low. So for the moment, but I believe that when she says he's a fascist, seen from here, from Paris, we think that it's going to make him weaker. But I fear that, as Lindsay said, that many of his voters or people maybe hesitating won't change their mind. The opposite. I mean, it might make him stronger because this is very much his speech as the elite versus the real people. And Kamala is using words that maybe many people today, many young people, maybe don't even... are not even able to define what is a fascist or what it means, what it recovers. So it might sound like a how you say that, a word of savant, you know, of something...
Like it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm?
Yes, like almost like it's a good thing, you mean.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like why is she angry or something like that? And also having all these celebrities also can be totally counterproductive.
The other way.
In the other way.
Well, talking about US at home, let's talk about the US abroad. Tuesday, Antony Blinken arriving in Tel Aviv, the 11th visit to the Middle East for the US Secretary of State in a year of war, which has only expanded to several fronts in that time, despite continuous calls from the White House to contain the conflict, call for ceasefire, pause to hostilities. Then after the news of the killing of Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader most wanted on Israel's hit list, the momentum quickly moved on. IDF troops, tanks moving into the north of the territory, a military assault that the UN chief Antonio Guterres called an Israeli siege, where thousands of people are suffering in the north, rapidly exhausting all available means for their survival. Israel's government saying, well, he is now persona non grata, revoking his visa. Antony Blinken's latest diplomatic push taking him to Doha, Qatar, to talk up the prospects of a new truce. Egypt has submitted a proposal for an initial two-week ceasefire. This is what Antony Blinken had to say.
We had an opportunity today to talk about the way forward on the effort to bring the hostages home and to get a ceasefire. Partly this involves an assessment of exactly where Hamas stands in the wake of the death of Sinwar. We talked about that. We talked about options to capitalize on this moment and next steps to move the process forward. And I anticipate that our negotiators will be getting together in the coming days.
It's easy to be, well, not optimistic here. We've been here before, talks, nothing happens, things fall apart. Could the absence of Yahya Sinwar, his, you know, the influence, the chances of success, it seems like that period has ebbed away a little bit. Do you think there is a possibility now that we've reached a new point for a ceasefire, or do you feel like it's gone?
Honestly, I feel like there's nothing rational here. I tried, I mean, for even with the Lebanese attacks, etc., I tried to find rationality in many of the things happening, and you don't find it. It's totally irrational. I mean, when we see how Guterres was treated by Israel, Guterres was treated by Israel and his persona non grata, I mean, this is totally unacceptable, or it would be totally unacceptable from any Western democracy. And Israel is often ranked or classified in the Western democracy. And when you say that to Israeli supporters, they tell you, oh, look what's happening in Saudi Arabia, or look what's happening in Syria, or look, and they compare themselves then to terrible countries with terrible human rights record. So there's nothing rational. It's difficult to say, yes, it would be. I thought after the killing of Nasrallah and the killing of almost all the chain of command of Hezbollah, it would be very good gains, let's say, for Netanyahu. He could stop there and say, look, in 10 days, look what we did, great job, etc. But no, it's continuing and it's terrible and nothing says it would stop.
But in 10 days, look what we did. In 10 days from now, look what's happening in the US. And I just wonder your point, your thoughts, Anna, on whether, you know, the talk in the Israeli press that the US influence is on hold, that nothing would happen until the outcome of the election, with not wanting to hand an election gift from Netanyahu to Kamala Harris. He wants Trump to win.
Well, let's be honest. US influence on hold. It's continuously on hold. Netanyahu has several times boasted about giving orders to Washington, whoever is in government in the White House. And it's absolutely true. If the United States is wanted to stop this genocide in Gaza, this attack on Lebanon, this crazy run to the Third World War, or at least to a very wide regional war, they could. They will not. And we are talking about Musk later, before doing what he's doing, and it's totally questionable. There is AIPAC as well, which is a lobby in the United States from Israel, it's in the name, that also influences the policies and the elections in the United States, and then no one talks about it. So that's one thing. Second, Blinken has been 10 times before, as you said, in the Middle East in a peace or ceasefire mission, has been blistering defeats. Why? I don't think because they are really, really involved. So in the end, the United States, Israel, I mean, Netanyahu, because Israel is a complex country with different opinions. Netanyahu keeps Israel and his country in a total permanent sense of trauma since the 7th of October. There is no rationale, there is difficulty for rationality to be used in the country. Sinwar's death might also have, I mean, it was too late. After Hezbollah and Nasrallah, it was also too late. And no one in the country and almost no one in the world trusts anymore the United States in foreign relations to make a ceasefire or to make a treaty, because Nasrallah was killed, let's not forget it, while France and the United States were negotiating a ceasefire between Hezbollah and Israel.
Walk at the U.S.?
Hezbollah had said yes,
yes,
according to a prime minister of Lebanon, and they were together in that, which was a horrendous mistake, security mistake, in that bunker, because they're expecting Netanyahu to say that he also accepted it. I mean, in the end, France, I don't believe, was in the knowing, but were the United States in the going or not? United States cannot be trusted for so long. Ask the Kurds, ask the North Koreans, ask everybody in the world. They cannot be trusted, you know, in international relations.
Here's the thing. Here's the thing, Lindsay. If we look ahead, let's step ahead, because at some stage there has to be talks, there has to be some kind of peace, and we have to look towards a future for Gaza. Now, one man many Palestinians speak of as a future leader, Marwan Barghouti, in an Israeli prison. Israel called him a terrorist, turned away from peace. Palestinians speak of him as their Nelson Mandela. You are still the only Western journalist to have interviewed him. Let's have a listen to this from more than 16 years ago. Oh, I don't think the gallery can find it, but Lindsay, effectively, you went to his cell. You met him. Tell me about your thoughts on Marwan Barghouti, and is that a possibility?
Absolutely. And well, maybe, but I think we're talking a long way ahead. I, like Amar, was in Lebanon. I came back 2 days ago. And what I see is an Israel which has no restraints on it whatsoever. The Americans are exercising almost no diplomatic power at all, I would say, because the only thing that will stop Israel now is if the Americans stop selling them weapons. And the Americans have made it quite clear that they're not going to do that. So when I look back to 16 years ago, when I interviewed Marwan Barghouti in prison, Marwan Barghouti was one of the leaders of the Second Intifada. He was a street fighter. I used to know him when I was covering the Second Intifada. You could always know where he was because there'd be a knot of people round something which you couldn't see because he's very short. Mm-hmm. And he's this little bloke in a leather jacket, and there he was leading the Shabab, the youth. And then he was convicted of 5 counts of murder in an Israeli court, which he refused to recognize. They let me go and interview him because it was just before an election in Gaza, the election in which Hamas came to office. This was in 2006. They thought that his voice coming out might persuade people to vote for Fatah, the more, inverted commas, moderate grouping, rather than Hamas. If you had said to me then, nobody else will get to interview Marwan Barghouti and he will still be languishing in jail 16 years later, I wouldn't have believed you, because he struck me exactly as the kind of person like Nelson Mandela or Gerry Adams or all of these kind of people who lead a militant organization and who may well have done terrible things, but who have a vision for peace, mm-hmm. in which you have to swallow hard and shake hands. As, you know, as his jailer, his Israeli jailer said to me as I was leaving, he said, I used to just see Palestinians through the sights of my guns, but now I've talked to Marwan Barghouti. He said, you make friends with your enemy. You make peace with your enemy, not with your friend.
Yeah.
That is not how many Israelis I know are thinking today.
I spoke with his son recently. I'm sure you have a number of times. And also the documentary maker who just made a documentary about his life.
Arab, yes.
We're going to this is the last interview he did on tape. Let's take a look at this interview with Lindsay.
Barghouti shares a tiny cell with two other prisoners. For 3 years, he was kept in solitary confinement. Now he says he's locked up 21 hours a day. We crammed inside for the interview.
I was in the solitary confinement during most of the time. I didn't see anybody. I didn't receive my children or my wife or anybody. I didn't. You are the first journalist, you and Al Jazeera and the others, who I see. This is the first day in my life in the prison during 5 years, 4 years that I met anybody.
As you say, Lindsay, that he hasn't done another interview since then. Just briefly, your thoughts on actually whether... You mentioned you think this is too far away, but whether he comes into the frame again, it looks like Israel, would they release him?
Oh. Not at the moment, no. You know, Arab Barghouti, his son, said to me a while back, I saw him in Ramallah, and he looked at me and he said, you know, I'm really jealous of you. And I said, why? He said, because you touched my father. You shook his hand, didn't you? And I've not been allowed to do that since he was in prison. I can only see him through a screen. And he's only been able to see him, I think, twice or maybe three times. I think that Marwan Barghouti, in principle, does have the possibility of being a leader who could unite different Palestinian factions. But with Israel the way it is now, having moved so far to the right, I cannot see them agreeing to release him. And I think another possibility is if they did, Hamas might insist that he went into exile, which would then decrease his possibility of doing any kind of leadership. So I hate to be so gloomy, but at the moment, I see no way through this. I think that Netanyahu is making tactical gains. I think he has no strategic vision. Mm. And from what I saw in Lebanon and what we're seeing in Gaza, what is happening now is creating many more people, Palestinians, Lebanese, who are with a deep hatred for Israel because they're watching their people, their families. The man I saw the other day in a house that had been bombed, scrabbling through the rubble for his five-year-old son and picking out a sack and shouting, are these the Hezbollah weapons? And he emptied the sack and they were full of his son's plastic toys. Does anybody watching that want to make a deal with Israel or are they full of hatred for Israel?
And it speaks of the import of being there, Lindsay, doesn't it? This question we keep begging to see what's going on in Gaza as international correspondents, it just makes that even louder.
Oh, yes.
Let's look at the situation in the Russian city of Kazan this week and the meets and greets that were going on, the geopolitics, smiles, handshakes, hugs and laughter on show with this man, Vladimir Putin. The BRICS summit of emerging nations started out as Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, including a much more diverse scrabble of letters, including Iran, Egypt, Ethiopia, the UAE. Leaders from more than 16 other countries there having applied to join the bloc or expressing a interest. Also there, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey's president, notably addressing Mr. Putin as my dear friend, notably because he's the only NATO leader at the summit, an alliance which classifies Russia as, quote, the most significant and direct threat to security and peace and stability in Europe and the US, according to its strategic concept. Let's hear from President Putin when it comes to Ukraine and Kyiv's intelligence assessment. North Korean troops will be sent to the battlefield as early as this weekend.
As for our relations with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, our strategic partnership treaty was ratified only today. This is Article 4, and Russia never doubted that the North Koreans are serious about Russian cooperation. But what we will do and how we will do it is our business.
In Latvia, President Putin's visual display that he's far from being an international pariah, despite facing a warrant for his arrest at the International Criminal Court. How do you see this, Inna, this week at the BRICS summit?
It was also, we were following very closely what's going on in Kazan these days, because there were several messages we took from this summit. And of course, one of the worrying things was, of course, also UN Secretary General's visit in Kazan, which was something extraordinary and unacceptable, totally unacceptable. And we also received a lot of critics about this. Turkey's President Erdogan, his visit to Russia wasn't so much surprising, because he is always trying to be in between Russia and Ukraine, to be moderator, to try to keep both sides. But actually, we didn't hear so much support as Putin wanted. There were many countries, but support for his war in Ukraine, we didn't hear so much about that. So I think altogether, Putin can be not so much
as pleased as he might be, you think?
Yes, 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 exactly. So I think that's also in a way good if we look at this summit from this point.
Very interesting on Ukraine. No denial that the troops were on the way, saying it was up to the country and up to their relations with North Korea. And also interesting from Vladimir Zelensky questioning why Antonio Guterres was there. Ina, thank you. Well, next, the old rule in journalism to tell what's happening. You have to narrow the distance between yourself and the story. But if the story the correspondent brings us are from war zones, we hear about the fatigue of the audience watching, but not so much of those repeatedly covering the story of conflict, which lasts, well, long memories and potential trauma too. What's in the toolbox of a war correspondent who has to tell some of the hardest, darkest stories over the decades? For Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4's international editor, there is an essential kit that she spoke of travelling with on every deployment, one that shaped itself over the years. They include the casing of a bullet from a near miss and a book of poetry, always. Light to explain the darkness. Lindsay's book, as you can see, I Brought the War With Me, stories from poems from the front line just been released. Lindsay, let's begin. Your essential travel kit. I mentioned a couple of things that are in it. Tell us why.
Well, I think that I've always read poetry, and that when you go to these conflicts, I find sometimes I run out of words. You know, the language which journalists have, we're trying to do who, what, when, where, and why. And Amar is trying to take the best photograph to show people what it's really like. But sometimes I think the deeper meaning and the feeling of what it's really like to be there and what the people are going through, poetry conveys that much better than we can. And so I suppose it's where I feel my own words have run out. That's where I turn to poetry. And it does give some solace, because it's both a distancing and a connection. I think that when, you know, I read a poem by someone which I relate to, because I connect with it. Yes, you've experienced the same as me, this horrendous, painful situation. What I was just talking about, this man with the sack of his five-year-old boy's toys and searching for his son's body. A poet can express that and I connect, but it also gives me a certain distance as well. It's an ability to step back if I am so emotionally involved and I'm too upset. Sometimes, somehow or other, poetry helps me with that.
And you've broken the poems into chapters characterised, interestingly, not by places, but by themes. Tell us about that. And if you can, we'd love to hear something you think might be particularly fitting this week.
Well, I think I didn't want to do it chronologically or by place, because part of the point is my stories, the book comprises 50 of my own stories, my own reportage, and each one is twinned with a poem. And the stories, therefore, are specific from a particular time and place where I was as an eyewitness journalist. But the poetry, the poem can make it universal, because there are themes which go across all conflicts, and they're not always miserable. I have a story about love. My friends Ward and Hamza, who fell in love in Aleppo when they were rebelling against Bashar al-Assad. Their rebellion was to fall in love, get married, and have a baby. Mm. That was their act of defiance. And so there's something rather glorious about that. But I suppose if I'm thinking offhand, I'm thinking, as you can tell, I'm thinking about that child, that five-year-old child. And there's a wonderful poem by Siegfried Sassoon in the book called The Child at the Window, which is when his own child, he comes back from a ride and his own son, George, who was also 5 years old, is up at the window and smiling and waving. And Siegfried Sassoon, he knows that terrible things are about to happen because World War I is over and World War II is about to happen. And in the poem, he says, "But you must learn beyond bewildering years that little things beloved and held are best. The windows of the world are blurred with tears and troubles come like cloud banks from the west. Remember this some afternoon in spring when your own child looks down and makes your sad heart sing."
It's heartbreaking, isn't it? And it's sort of sweet at the same time. I think you touch upon that. The phrase you use to look at that situation, saying the World One map of wastening war unrolled. And you can sort of see that vision from the wars all the way to now. And you talked about that sometimes not being able to say the words. I want to bring Amar in here because I want to just listen to what Lindsay was saying. Some of your photos, they have been categorised as incredibly poetic and perhaps where poetry meets the photographic field. Tell us about some of these that we're looking at.
Yes, I totally agree with Lindsay when she says that our main work, especially with photos also, is to bring the 5W, where, when, how, who, etc. inside. But these photos don't have these 5Ws. It could be anywhere. This is in Comoros. The first one was in Lebanon. But they bring something. They bring an emotion to people. They bring a feeling that they feel bad or they feel sad or they feel good. It brings something. It says something just like a poem. Well, this one might
be... Tell us about this one. This is incredible.
This is the port of Beirut a few days after the explosion in 2020. This one might have the more information than the other ones. But maybe we'll see different ones.
It's like Doomsday.
Yeah, some people say that. Mm. This is in Yemen, for instance, and it's for me it's very poetic because I know nothing about this lady and her child, but the way she stands, the mask she's wearing, that's very different from the niqab or from other things, gives her some mystery. That is for me poetry. Poetry is also about words you cannot define, feelings, something like that. This is also in Casablanca, in Morocco, and it's some people see in it the small man versus the big monument or things like that. So I love that. It's very complicated because I come from a country or from an area where poetry is very, very important. Mm-hmm. You know, like until today, you have TV programs where people tell poetry, which we don't have anymore in the West. You know, in Europe, it's something you don't really find a lot. You have probably, Lindsay maybe witnessed it, but you have, for instance, the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. When Mahmoud Darwish died, you had a funeral. That is incredible, you know, a huge funeral. I don't know, I have no idea who today in France, for instance, could have such a funeral.
May I cut in? I had the chance of being with Mahmoud Darwish in Bordeaux many years ago. And I remember it was a cultural symposium over there. And I remember young girls on the street who'd come to him, most Arabic girls, and they would just be like, you know, fans from, I don't know, from rock stars. He was treated like a rock star. Sometimes
exactly.
He was a little bit vexed because they would say, "My mother introduced me to you." But they were all very beautiful and they were all telling him how much they loved and how much they were in love with him. And his poems are so magnificent.
Lindsay, you're nodding.
Exactly.
This is familiar to you.
Yes, I am. And I'm also thinking of Ukraine, because in every town square, there's a picture of this big bloke with the drooping moustache sitting on a chair, and that is Taras Shevchenko, who is the national poet. And in all of these situations where you find conflict, people are revering their national poets, and poetry is just pouring out of Ukrainians. There's a whole new, you know, so many Ukrainians are now turning to poetry. And similarly, in Gaza, Moussa Baboutoha, who is a Gazan poet who writes in English, has a new book out. And other poets as well in Gaza are writing so much because these extreme and terrible situations, people need to express themselves. And in, I think that in other cultures, people turn to poetry more easily than maybe we do in Western culture. And I asked a Somali friend, you know, to when I was doing the book, to recommend a Somali poet. And he looked at me absolutely, you know, insulted and said, but every Somali is a poet. Well, the language was only written down in 1973. It has a huge oral tradition. They've had a lot of conflict. So pretty much every Somali is a war poet, I think.
It's really interesting. Notably this week as well, the British singer Kate Bush contemplating war too on Ukraine, saying, like you did, Lindsay, sometimes words can't do it. She's released a short film called Little Shrew, using a story of a cartoon animal to speak of the war zone in Ukraine. Well, our time is drawing to a close tonight. Thank you to Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4 News international editor. It's been a pleasure. Author of I Brought the War With Me, Stories and Poetry from the Front Line. Also to Ina Strazdina, the presenter, foreign correspondent, Latvia's LTV, Amar Abadrabo, French Syrian photojournalist, Knight of Art and Letters in France. And thank you to one of Portugal's finest escritoras, French-based journalist Ana Navarro Pedro. With poetry the theme this evening, we leave you with the official theme from COP16 Summit on Biodiversity, taking place in Cali, Colombia. This is the world-renowned Cali band Monsieur Perinet singing a poem that has been turned into a song about the search for peace with nature. Hasta la próxima, bienes. We'll see you in 7 days for the world next week.